We're going to be going over church history this morning, so the title for our lesson is going to be The Faithfulness of Christ to Build His Church. This is going to be part one of what I'm hoping to be a two-part, but it might turn into a three-part series over our new subject of Catholicism. The reason Catholicism is going to get our special treatment is because it's so significant and so relevant to Christianity as a whole, but also specifically Christianity in McPherson. And what I mean by that is, in my experience, Christians struggle with Catholicism and Catholics. We're not quite sure what to do with them. We know that there's differences, but how severe are these differences, right? Are these differences between like a Methodist and a Baptist, or are they more severe? Are we free to consider them our brothers and sisters with whom we disagree, or are they people that are in need of our compassion and our prayers and the efforts of our evangelism, okay? So that is, to answer that question, I'm really wanting to discuss that the next lesson, but it's going to serve us this morning to kind of front load a little bit of the answer. And our position towards Roman Catholicism, and by extension Catholics, is that they are in need of evangelism. And the reason for that is Rome peddles a different gospel. Okay, if you were to embody Roman Catholicism and Protestantism, and you were to ask the question, how can I have peace with God? How can I be made right with God? You're going to get two different answers, okay? And somebody is wrong, okay? If you have a false gospel, you have an unsaving gospel, okay? Now, again, I want to get more into the nitty-gritty of that in the next lesson. But for this lesson, that bears a significant question, okay? If it's true that Roman Catholicism is an apostate church, and it is, then the question naturally becomes, where has the church been before the Protestant Reformation, right? Here I am saying that Rome has a different gospel, and we know that the Roman Catholic Church was what church history is all the way up until 1517. Martin Luther posted his 95 Theses on the door at Wittenberg. What about Christ? You know, I'm going to build my church and the gates of Hades will not prevail against it. What do we do with church history for 1,500 years? Do you see the issue here? Now, to answer that question, I would say there is a huge misconception about church history among Christians and Catholics, really. I think a lot of Christians' idea of church history goes something kind of like, you know, at the end of the first century, the last apostle, John, died, and immediately the church fell into Roman Catholicism, and then 1,500 years later, you know, Martin Luther did his thing. The Protestant Reformation happened. And after that, John Calvin and Jacob Arminius were born, and they had an argument about free will and predestination. And after they hashed that out, Jacob Arminius established the Methodist Church. John Calvin established the Puritans. And after the Puritans came Charles Spurgeon. After Charles Spurgeon came John MacArthur. And here we are today, right? That's church history in a nutshell for the average Christian, and that is just totally false. So the goals for this morning really are to show you that, okay, you've heard Rome wasn't built in a day. Neither was Roman Catholicism, okay? The church history is not a story of Roman Catholicism, all right? Roman Catholicism is something that developed, and I want to show you that. Also understand, I'm going to try to go through about 1,000 years of church history in one Sunday school lesson. I am making, this is super survey, all right? There's not going to be a whole lot of detail, so if you want to, you know, get more into church history, I can give you different resources. But also, I want you to see, most importantly, the faithfulness of Christ to build his church. You're going to, if you get into church history, you're going to see the faithfulness of Christ to build his church, and you're going to see the church warts and all right? The church had some wacky views, and they did some bad things. But nevertheless, this is the story of Christ building his church. My favorite church history volume is called 2,000 Years of Christ Power. And because church history is a story of Christ building his church. So, with that being said, that's kind of the goal. I just want you to sit back, relax. I'm not trying to get you to memorize dates or names. My only goal is that if you ever hear that, it's like, well, Roman Catholicism was the belief of the church for all of church history. I just want your response to be like, no. That's it. So just relax and listen to storytelling, okay? So to begin with, church history obviously starts in the Bible, right? Acts 2. This is the time of the church that we call the apostolic era. So all that means is the apostles are on the earth at this time, right? And if you want to know what the early church believed at this time, you would look through the window of the New Testament. So we're going to be tracing what did the leadership of the church look like and what were the beliefs of the church, generally speaking, all right? So during the apostolic era, we would find in the New Testament that concerning the leadership of the church, you have a plurality of elders, right? Elders, overseers, the terms are episkopos and presbyteros. That's going to be significant later on. And they're used interchangeably, okay? You could call them bishops as the episkopos, and presbyters could be pastors or priests, whatever. But the point is, in the apostolic era, these terms were interchangeable. Church was led by a plurality of these figures, and they were supported by a plurality of deacons, right? And so as with respect to beliefs, you know, hopefully you agree, they believed in justification by faith alone, right? By the grace of God alone, in Christ alone. With respect to communion, we call it communion because we're emphasizing the nature of what's happening, right? So we're communing with God's people and we're communing with Christ. The early church called it the Eucharist, which I know it's like, Catholics called it that. It's okay. It's okay. Eucharist just means giving thanks. So instead of describing it as the nature of what's happening, they're describing what they were doing, right? They were giving thanks. So we're going to call it the Eucharist from now on in this lesson. But don't freak out about that, okay? It seems like the church in the apostolic era believed in what we would call a memorial view of the Eucharist. It's bread, it's wine, and they're doing it in remembrance of Christ and what he did, right? Then when it comes to issues of purgatory, it's not there. In the apostolic era, you're not going to find any mentions of purgatory. You're not going to find any mentions of veneration of Mary or the saints, all right? So that's the apostolic era, and that's in the first century. But now we're going to get into, we're outside of the Bible now. We've moved out of the apostolic era. And what we're going to cover right now is a section of, it's called the patristic age of the church. That's just from the first century to about the sixth century, okay? So in the patristic age, the church starts facing an issue called Gnosticism, okay? How many of you have ever heard of Gnosticism before? Okay, so Gnosticism was a heresy that, it's not a monolithic belief, okay? There was no, like, this is Gnosticism. It wasn't unified by any stretch of the imagination. There was different flavors of it. But what they all had in common was they believed that there was a secret knowledge, that they were this elite group that the Lord had passed on, this secret elite knowledge to the apostles and ultimately to them. And salvation could only be had through this secret knowledge. They renounced the material world as being evil. They rejected sexuality and things like that. They thought all sorts of these crazy things, but the most famous Gnostic heresy that the church battled was against a guy named Marcion. He believed that the God of the Old Testament was evil. He's not the same as the God of the New Testament, and the God of the New Testament sent Jesus to enlighten us to spiritual realities. All right, they don't believe that Jesus actually came in the flesh. He was just a spirit being. Okay, and so this is the heresy that was floating around between 130 and 160 AD, okay? So the church has to fight this, and so you have a man take the stage named Irenaeus of Lyons. He has a book called Against Heresies that he responds to the Gnostics, and it's at this point that the church takes on the name Catholic, okay? Coming from the Greek Catholikos, meaning universal. Remember, the Gnostics, it was not a unified belief. There was different kinds of Gnosticism. Whereas the church said, all right, let's band together. We have one belief, and so we'll call ourselves the Catholic Church. You can't, now you don't want to read backwards, right? Don't associate Roman Catholicism with this. We're not there yet. They just called themselves Catholic. So right now, Catholics are the good guys in church history, all right? At this time, also, there was an emphasis on apostolic tradition, right? Because here you have Gnostics saying we have this secret knowledge that you need to have and supposedly was passed on from the apostles. Well, now the church finds a need to look at, all right, well, what did the apostles actually write, right? So they want to preserve apostolic writings. Marcion had a bad habit of throwing out books in the New Testament that he disagreed with. So the response of the Catholic Church is to keep all of these books that the apostles wrote or were sanctioned by the apostles, right? Such as Acts was written by Luke, right? Luke wasn't an apostle. So we want to keep the apostolic writings. We also have something called the Rule of Faith. It was a summary of apostolic teaching. This is where, if you're familiar with the Apostles' Creed, that's a summary of the teaching, all right? That became a big deal. But also, an emphasis came on apostolic churches, churches that were founded by the apostles. So Rome would have a preeminent status among other churches, right? Because the apostles established that church. In the East, you had the church in Jerusalem and Antioch. There was a lot of them in the East, but in the West, you primarily had Rome. So those churches enjoyed some precedence. So now at this time, we're in the second century, right? What does the church look like with respect to leadership and beliefs? Well, we're just out of the apostolic era, right? The apostles have died. And so now leadership looks pretty much the same. You still have a plurality of elders. However, there's starting to be some development in wanting to have a single guy as the leader, right? So you would read this in Ignatius. He encourages the churches to look to the bishop, all right? This is where we're going to lean on the episkopos and the presbyteros, right? We knew it in the New Testament, these are interchangeable terms. And even in the early church fathers, we still see those terms being interchangeable. But eventually it develops into making a distinction between the episkopos and the presbyteroi, right? So you have one bishop and the presbyters serving him. But he is a leader amongst equals, okay? It's not like he's just the ruler. We're not looking at the pope, all right? But he was kind of, we kind of rail against this, but you think of Josh and Jerry and Paul, they are totally equal with respect to their office, right? But we understand that Josh preaches, and so you could kind of look at it that way. But again, we really like pushing that they are equal, okay? So you have the bishop being distinctive from the presbyters, if you will. And then they still have deacons serving under them. So pretty similar, pretty much the same as the apostolic era. With respect to beliefs, it's also pretty much the same. Justification by faith. The Eucharist became known as they were calling it a sacrifice, okay? But it was a sacrifice of thanksgiving. When they partook in the Eucharist, they were offering up their thanksgiving, all right? And that's what it is, right? So this is the development in the early church, all right? So when you're thinking about the early church, yes, you want to think about what's going on in church life, but you also have to recognize the context in which the early church existed, and that is the Roman Empire. Remember, the early church Christianity was a religion of persecution, right? There were some phases in there where Christianity experienced some relief, but for the most part, the Roman Empire persecuted Christianity. And so this takes us to looking at the Roman Empire at large. And so something significant would happen in 284 AD, all right? And that is when the Emperor Diocletian was reigning, and he decided to split the empire into the east and the west administrative spheres, if you will. And so that looks something. So this is my map. It's very, yes. Anyway, can you guys even see it back there? All right. See the boot? This is Italy. All right. And this is Spain. And this is Africa. All right. So anyway, so the split went something like this, kind of. But anyway, so when Diocletian did this, this would actually, he divided it into districts, and this would help the empire survive for an additional 1,000 years. Now, what he did was, in these two sections, you would have an Augustus, all right? And he's the superior. And below him would be a Caesar. Now, in Diocletian's view, the Augustus would reign for 20 years, and after that, he would step down, and the Caesar would take his spot. And that Caesar would become the Augustus, and he would appoint a Caesar under him. You get the idea. So Diocletian took for himself the east, all right? And under him was a man named Galerius, okay? And in the west, he appointed a man named Maximian as the Augustus. And under him was the Caesar Constantius, all right? Now remember, you don't have to remember all this, but so you have Diocletian and Galerius in the east, and Maximian and Constantius in the west. Now, after some time, Diocletian steps down, and he forces Maximian as well to step down in the west, right? So Galerius takes his spot, and eventually a man named Licinius would become the Caesar under Galerius. And again, I got to zip through this. So after Galerius steps down, you have a man named Maximian and Licinius. So in the east, we have Maximian and Licinius. In the west, when Maximius steps down, Constantius becomes the Augustus, and eventually under him was a man named Maxentius. This was Maximius. Yes, I know, it gets very confusing. Maximius' son, Maxentius. So Constantius and Maxentius in the west. Now, Constantius rules Britain, Spain, and France, all right? Maxentius has Italy and northwestern Africa. We're gonna focus on the west for the most part, all right? Now, eventually, Constantius dies, and so his troops make his son the new ruler of Spain, France, and Britain, and his son's name is Constantine, all right? You've probably heard the name Constantine, and that is because he goes down in history as Constantine the Great, and with good reason. Now, in 312, war breaks out between Constantine and Maxentius, right? So Constantine brings his troops, invades Italy, and he is on the river Tiber, all right? And it flows outside of Rome. And here history would be changed forever for the church and really for the world, because Constantine is outnumbered and he's on the enemy's turf. Right? And so as the story goes, Constantine was sleeping, and he had a dream. And in this dream, two Greek letters appeared before him, chi and rho. The chi looks like an English X, and a rho looks like an English P. All right? But they're the first two letters of the Greek word Christ. Okay, and they come together to form a cross. And in the dream, either there's words, or he heard a voice that said, in this sign you will conquer, all right? So when he awakes, he prays to the Christian God to give him victory, and the next day he goes to battle. This is the Battle of the Milvian Bridge, and he, by God's providence, he wins. He marches into Rome, and he is the ruler of the Western Empire, and so it is at this point that Constantine would become the champion and the protector of the Christian faith. Now, in the east, you have Maximian and Licinius warring with each other, and Licinius wins, but Licinius starts to persecute Christians. And so Constantine feels that he has an obligation, as this, you know, finding his newfound faith, to go to war with Licinius, and he prevails. And now Constantine is the uncontested ruler of the entire empire, all right? So Constantine moves his capital to Byzantium. It used to be in Rome, obviously, but now he establishes it in Byzantium, which would be referred to as Constantinople, all right? Now, the effects that Constantine had on church history are enormous, all right? For starters, now the church is no longer persecuted, right? It's free to worship publicly, which is a big, big deal, okay? Furthermore, before Constantine, you worked on Sunday, right? That's just the way it is, which means going to church is kind of difficult. No one gets off at the same time necessarily, and you go home, get your family, and generally speaking in those days, you would bring some food to celebrate the Eucharist. They did it every Sunday in the early church. That was kind of the heart of worship at the time. And so now Constantine makes an edict that all the workshops were to be closed and no one's to work on Sunday. He made a provision for farmers due to convenience, but generally speaking, everything's closed now, which means worshiping on Sunday is a lot easier, okay? It's important to note Christians were already worshiping on Sunday, okay? So anyway, so Constantine makes it easier for Christians to worship, and really this is where the government and the church start to become pretty friendly, okay? Because when Constantine takes the East, he finds the church in a battle against a new heresy called Arianism. If you were here for our Sunday school on the heretics, you would be familiar with Arius. Arianism is just the profession of what Jehovah's Witnesses believe. Jesus is the first created being of God, but he is not eternally God himself. All right? Arius felt to say that Jesus was God was to violate monotheism, the idea that there was only one God. And so there's a battle going on in the Eastern churches of, is Jesus God or is he not God, right? And so Constantine calls the first ecumenical council. There's seven ecumenical councils. When we say ecumenical, it just comes from the Greek word oikumene, the inhabited earth. So the idea is we're going to bring all the bishops together around the empire. Not all of them, but I think there was about 300 bishops and even more presbyters that attended. And we're going to hash this issue out of Arianism, all right? Is Jesus God or is he not? So this is the Council of Nicaea that you've heard of. It happened in 325 AD, and there was a decisive victory against Arianism, and Jesus is God. Yes, it is. Saint Nick punched a guy or slapped him. Anyway, and he got in trouble for that. Actually, he got thrown out, I'm pretty sure. So you have the first ecumenical council, and you have the Nicene Creed. And remember, you can thank God, but you can thank Constantine for a lot of the creeds that you enjoy, or that you should enjoy if you haven't read them. And that's because, remember, if you're a Christian before Constantine, you're persecuted. You don't just get out in broad daylight and gather together in mass and hash these issues out, right? It is under Constantine where the church can finally begin to work itself out as far as what have we been teaching, what do we believe, all right? So when you hear people talking about, well, the church didn't even believe in the Trinity until the 4th century, it's like, give the church some time to deal with these issues. They were dealing with Gnosticism in the 1st and 2nd century. Like, chill, okay? Constantine helps immensely with the freedom of Christians and also buildings. I know it sounds odd, but designated buildings for Christian worship become a thing because, again, a lot of time churches were happening in people's houses. Okay, and so now we can actually erect buildings where everyone can come together. Now, with respect to the leadership and beliefs of the church at this time, so we've moved from the 1st and 2nd century into the 3rd and 4th century. Okay, with respect to the leadership, now remember, Christianity is getting bigger, right? the leaders, you have the bishops, but now you have the development of archbishops as well. And all that means is you would have bishops in various cities, right? But then in cities that were considered to be, for lack of a better word, more important than other cities, that bishop was given certain favor over these other bishops. And so he was referred to as a metropolitan bishop or an archbishop, okay? And above him was, remember how I was telling you how the apostolic churches began to have certain precedence over the other ones? Well, there would emerge to be five churches that would have major influence over the rest of the churches. In the east, that would be Antioch, Jerusalem, Alexandria, and Constantinople. Okay, the reason for Constantinople is because it is the new capital, right? In the west, however, it was Rome, right? There wasn't really any other church that had this sort of reputation. And so you have the bishops and you have the archbishops now, but in these major cities, you have the patriarchs now, because there's certain favor that's given to them as being apostolic churches, except for Constantinople, all right? And they began to give an affectionate name to these bishops, Papia, which is Pope, all right? However, remember, there's not just one Pope, all right? There's five, and they're patriarchs. Now, for the rest of the time, we're going to refer to the ones in the east as the patriarchs, and we're going to refer to the one in the west as the Pope. Bear in mind, though, that they could all be called popes, and they could all be called patriarchs. All right? Are we cool? Good to proceed? All right. So, that's the leadership. You now see the seeds of the papacy being sown, if you will. All right? With respect to beliefs, once again, there was justification by faith. Icons became a thing at this time. Pictures of Christ and various saints. This is in its primitive form, but it was used to help worship, and there was some form of venerating these icons, and the idea wasn't to worship the icon. What gave the icon value was Christ in the saint, and so that they were using these icons to help them in their worship, but again, this is in a very primitive form, right? Furthermore, the monastic movement started. You could call it the monk movement, all right? This is when monks become a big deal. The idea of withdrawing from society and shutting yourself out and living either in a community of monks or by yourself, and you would commit yourself to celibacy, and you would commit yourself to prayer and fasting and Bible study, and it was very popular, and it had immense ramifications for the church, especially in the Middle Ages, as we will see. In fact, probably the two main characters in the 3rd and 4th century that you might consider awesome is Augustine, right, and a man named Athanasius. Athanasius championed the deity of Christ at this time. And Athanasius was, well, both of them actually were influenced by monks, all right? With respect to purgatory, purgatory became an opinion in the 4th and 5th century floating around. It's really not in the mainstream of doctrine yet, okay? But nevertheless, these little opinions start popping up, okay? Now, with respect to the Eucharist, Augustine of Hippo, probably, he is. He's the most influential early church father in church history, okay? He develops a doctrine of the Eucharist, and in his conceptualization of the Eucharist, the bread and the wine are still bread, and they are still wine. Nevertheless, don't get mad at me. I'm just telling you what they did in history. It doesn't have to make sense. This is just the way it is. Even though it's bread and wine and they're symbols, Christ is still in these elements, okay? And that's about all you get. The early church fathers are kind of ambiguous on their beliefs of the Eucharist, okay? But that's the position that Augustine holds, and that kind of becomes the position of the church as we move on, All right? So we have moved past the 3rd and 4th century, I believe. Let's see here. Yes. All right. Also important to note that the West, you're going to start seeing the West and the East dividing. The West starts to speak Latin. And the Greek, the East starts to speak, keeps speaking Greek. All right? So you're going to, we've got this divide that's slowly happening. All right? So now we're going to, we're jumping out of the church again, and we're going to go back to the status of the empire. All right? So we're going to deal with the fall of the West. A lot of our lessons is going to be focusing on the West, all right? So at this time, you have these Germanic tribes that start to migrate into the East, all right? And they do this because there's a threat that's facing them, the Huns, all right? You're familiar with Attila the Hun. And this just blows my mind. How bad of an enemy are you facing if your best option is to, like, take on the Roman Empire? That just kills me. But technically, they don't just full out go to war. They migrate in. And so they're pagans, right? But a lot of them adopt Arianism, okay? So they do acquaint themselves with Christianity, okay? But they migrate into the East. And eventually, they migrate west. And tragically, in 410, they sack Rome. All right? The West has fallen under the Ostrogoths. Okay? So the various tribes, you have the Ostrogoths, the Visigoths. Actually, I'm pretty sure it was the Visigoths that sacked Rome. You have the Angles, the Saxons, the Franks. All right? And so all of these tribes are moving in, and the West now is populated a lot by essentially Germans, okay? And so this has an immense effect on the church, right? Because, again, this is going to affect the separation between the East and the West as far as culture is concerned. Remember, you have a completely different people group moving into here. So, again, These Germans are largely pagan and Aryan, okay? Now, we move into seeing, oddly enough, the church actually manages to survive pretty well under the I'm calling them Germans, okay? But there's a lot of tribes, okay, Germanic tribes. They do pretty well. They do all right. But something eventful happens in one of the Frankish kings. Cloven, is it Cloven? I have it on my, it's Clovis, okay? Clovis was a Arian, but he married a girl named Clotilda who is a Catholic girl. And so she believes in the Trinity, right? Because the Catholics are on the side of orthodoxy for the early church period. And so he's not giving in to any of this, but in 496, he has a kind of a Constantine moment. He finds himself at war, competing with his enemies, and he prays to Jesus. He says, you know, I've heard that you're a savior. It's clear that my gods aren't going to help me, but, you know, if you save me, then I'll serve you, essentially. It's kind of the Constantine story, and it happens. He wins, and so he become the Franks become a hub for Catholicism to kind of spread into Europe, all right? And so he converts, and it is at this time we're going to kind of move now to the 6th century, 7th and 6th century, where you have Pope Gregory the Great, all right? Gregory was influential in the spread of Catholicism to Europe, all right? He especially England. Okay, because, yeah, you had Arians here, and some of them are converting to Catholicism. But in Britain, you have the Angles, all right? Angles, England. You see the picture? Okay. So these are still pagan, right? And so he champions some missionary work to go there, and it's wildly successful. And so under his rule, you see the conversion to Catholicism. Not Roman Catholicism. Catholicism. Okay. So so he's very helpful. Some of his beliefs, for one, he was against the veneration of icons, right? Also, he got especially upset because the emperor in the East declared the Patriarch of Constantinople, his name was John, to be the universal priest, okay? Now, this is something that the Pope today, like, would accept this title, okay? Gregory, Pope of Rome, right, was very upset about this and said, hey, any person that seeks that title or accepts that title is the Antichrist, all right? So this is something that is much to Catholics, you know, embarrassment, that you have Pope Gregory the Great who said this about any patriarch, all right? But furthermore, Gregory wasn't perfect. He believed in baptismal regeneration, all right? The idea that, like, being baptized saves you. And that was a prevalent belief, except it's not always what we think it is. So it gets confusing. But anyway, nevertheless, Pope Gregory the Great believed that. He also believed that you could make up for your, you had to make up for your sins after baptism, and you could do this from acts of love. So you can begin to see the gospel being a little adulterated, right? This is not to say that everyone believed this, but it is to say that you see this in the institution of the Catholic Church, right? And he, if there was any opinions about purgatory at that time, Gregory helped make it doctrine, all right? So Gregory was active between 590 and 604, to kind of give you a little timeline of where we want to put purgatory, okay? So we're going to move on from Pope Gregory, and we're going to move on to, I don't want to reveal his name yet, so we're going to call him Charles, and we're going to call him Charles because that's his name. That's pretty reasonable. So he's active between 771 and 814, and he established the Holy Roman Empire, all right? So at this time, you remember, you have all these Germanic tribes, right? We don't have one sole ruler, right? So Charles became known as Charles the Great, which in Latin you might call him Charles Magnus, all right, which we would call Charlemagne, okay? So, yes, there's the name, Charlemagne. He establishes the Holy Roman Empire, and the reason it's the Holy Roman Empire, for one, he conquers much of what was the West. If you want to see basically what he got, he pretty much, this is rough, it's not exact, but that's a good chunk of the West, all right? And the reason it's called the Holy Roman Empire, emphasis on holy, is because at this time you're going to start to see conflicts between the papacy and the monarchs, all right? And Pope Leo III at the time is wanting to establish his dominance, right? And so in the year 800, on Christmas Day, Charlemagne is attending service, and Pope Leo pulls out a crown and crowns Charlemagne, and everyone chants, you know, whatever it is they chant. I don't remember exactly, but the idea is long live the king, right? Woohoo, Charlemagne! And this is good. Charlemagne likes this, right? However, what he doesn't like is, in the view of the people, who crowned Charlemagne? The Pope. Which means, who has the power to crown kings? The Pope, right? So this became kind of a conflict between, and this wasn't just between Charlemagne and Leo. This would become a conflict that endures. So anyway, under Charlemagne, he really did reestablish a lot of the Western Empire. The East didn't like that too much, being referred to as the Holy Roman Empire, because as far as they're concerned, they are still I mean, they're the Romans from ancient Rome, right? They didn't fall to the West. So you can see, again, a little bit of disdain and divide occurring. Mm-hmm. Yes. Yes, it does. Yes, it does. So, anyway, so you have the East and the West having more disdain for each other. Charlemagne establishes more monasteries at this time. Monasteries are going to be a hub for Christian learning. They almost operate as schools at the time. And one of the issues that plagues the church is after the fall of Rome in the West, you begin to see a rapid decline in literacy, okay? Even amongst the clergy. The clergy don't really do much of their own sermons at this time. Homilies become popular. They just start quoting other people's sermons from earlier in church history. And so Charlemagne is trying to kind of combat that by establishing monasteries and increase learning, but nevertheless, the situation continued to look bleak. So remember, Charlemagne, 771 to 814, we're moving through history, okay? So the beliefs at the time, justification has become kind of adulterated, right? How a person is made right before God. I can't emphasize enough, though. I say all these, and it sounds like I'm making sweeping generalizations. This isn't to say that everyone believed this. The church is still there. And if we have time, I'll read some things. I doubt we will, though. So, justification is adulterated. At this time, Eucharist becomes referred to as the Mass, all right? And the reason for that is in Latin, at the end of the service, you have the congregation is dismissed. So it would be referred to as the Mass. And you have a development in clarifying what do people believe about the Mass, right? So you have a conflict in the 9th century, yeah, between a man named Radbertus and this guy's name is hard to say, Retramnus, okay? So Radbertus and Retramnus. Radbertus believes really what most of you probably think of when you think of what the Catholic Church today believes about the Mass. And Radbertus believed that the elements, the bread and the wine, actually became Christ's flesh and his blood, like in a very literal essence sense, right? And Retramnus is like, no way, Jose. He champions more of a symbolic view. It really sounds quite similar to Augustine. And that's, no, this stuff remains bread and remains wine. Nevertheless, Christ is in these elements spiritually, okay? The church pretty much agrees with both at the time, but eventually swings to the pendulum of Radbertus in that they actually become the flesh and the blood of Christ, all right? So those are some of the developments. And again, remember, icons are becoming more and more and more popular, especially in the East, all right? So now we're moving on, and we're going to jump to the 11th century. And this is the Great East and West Schism, all right? So first of all, remember, I've been telling you that the East and the West have been dividing. They're speaking different languages. Somebody once said that the East and the West didn't understand each other because they couldn't understand each other. That's true. Also, there was, I didn't touch on this, but immense rivalry commenced between the Pope in the West and the Patriarchs in the East, but mostly between Constantinople and Rome. Right, so there's rivalry going on there. There's also differences in beliefs. For one, with respect to priests, the West believed that priests shouldn't be allowed to marry, and in the East, that was no problem. Priests could marry, and that's fine. The East didn't believe in purgatory at all. This would become useful to the reformers to point out, it's like, look, are you going to say that the East aren't Christians? But they didn't believe in purgatory. Like, this isn't an ancient doctrine, all right? So the East didn't believe in purgatory. The East did venerate icons big time, something that the West kind of looked down on. Again, it's difficult to explain in a survey style, but this is something that the West would eventually swing even worse on. So remember, icons are pictures, all right? When the West started to venerate statues, the East freaked out. Like, that is, I mean, rightly so, essentially what we think. It's like, what are you doing, all right? But also, the biggest issue was the filioque clause, all right? So you have these ecumenical councils, right? You have the Nicene Council, and you have the Chalcedon and Constantinople, blah, blah, blah. Well, in the what we might call the updated Nicene Creed, based on a different ecumenical council, there's a statement made that the Spirit proceeds from the Father, all right? Well, the West inserted "and from the Son." In Latin, that's filioque, all right? So the East objected to this. This was a big, big, big deal. For one, they had theological reasons that they argued back and forth about that we won't get into. But number two, the reasonable objection is you have no right to insert this in an ecumenical council, or rather, based in an ecumenical creed that was produced on your own volition. You're not even consulting the other patriarchs, right? You have no authority to do this. Because remember, presumably, this is all unified, right? So that's a legitimate claim. Well, tensions were rising between the West and the East all the way to the point where the Pope marched into Hagia Sophia and laid down a document on the holy table and had a list of heretics that they were anathematizing. To anathematize is to put out of the church. You're out of the church. You're not saved if you're in the church, right? So there's this list of heretics that he's anathematizing, and among them is the Patriarch of Constantinople and even the devil himself, and they end it with amen, amen, and amen. And so as you can imagine, the East says, you know what, you're right, and they submit, right? That is not what happened. The East responds, okay, fine, well, you're anathematized, right? And now we have the division where we have the Roman Catholic Church is born. This is 1054 AD. The Roman Catholic Church is born, and Greek Orthodoxy is born, all right? So you now have two split churches that no longer recognize each other as legitimate believers. So what follows after the great East and West Schism is a lot of things. For one, the Crusades start, right? There was four Crusades. The first three were against Muslims. So that sounds like, you know, they just hated Muslims, which was true. But I'm not picking sides here. I'm just telling you what happened, all right? Previously, the Muslims took Jerusalem, all right, which was owned by the Eastern Empire. So the Muslims initiated war, okay? Well, eventually, even though the churches are split, the East asks the West to help them reclaim Jerusalem. And so the West is all for this because the West has, you know, people like to send missionaries, not missionaries, they like to send people on pilgrimages to Jerusalem, right? This is where you hear the Knights of Templar, who are always bad guys in movies, and maybe further study will vindicate that. However, based on my study, the Knights of Templar's job was to just protect pilgrims on the way to Jerusalem. That was their job. It's like, cool, Knights of Templar. Anyway, that could change on further study. But nevertheless, so you have the Crusades that commence and trying to take Jerusalem, all right? And it goes back and forth between the Muslims. The Fourth Crusade, oddly enough, really just ends up being the West doing a crusade on the East and ultimately capturing Constantinople, and the East falls. Weird, but nevertheless, that's what occurs in the Crusades. The Crusades from the first to the fourth is 1096 AD to 1204 AD. All right. right? So that's the period of the Crusades. Now, at this time, you have a major player on the scene as far as the papacy is concerned, who's active in 1198 to 1216, and that is Pope Innocent III. And to make a long story short, remember how I was telling you there was this ongoing conflict between the papacy and the different emperors slash kings? Well, Pope Innocent III effectively, so this is after the time of Charlemagne, right? In which case, when Charlemagne dies, he splits it up between his sons, which is always a bad idea because that means you split it up, right? And so eventually it goes back to this sort of just several monarchs, all right? Well, Pope Innocent III systematically, he plays this game of like, I'll declare you king because you're competing with this guy. And so they're warring with each other and they get weak and the papacy grows stronger to the point where he claims a lot of land and manipulates kings to his will. And this is when, you know, you think of the papacy of having all this power in this old times, but you don't really know because we don't really know the history that much. We've just seen Kingdom of Heaven, so it's like, ooh. But anyway, that's Pope Innocent III. He really takes control, and the papacy becomes a big, powerful deal. Furthermore, in this time, Scholasticism takes a scene in the church. Scholastic is just school, all right? They want to, at this time, it became important to marry reason and faith together. How far can just raw human reason lead you into the knowledge of God? They also loved Aristotle and wanted to take his teachings and blend them with Christianity. And this is where you get a lot of critical thinkers, but you also get a lot of just unreasonable thinking in, about biblical matters. At this time, what does the beliefs look like? So we know what the church looks like now. The papacy has taken the scene. You have priests, you have monasteries, and kind of what you think of with Roman Catholicism. But what do they believe? All right, justification, faith, plus works. Your Roman Catholic conceptualization is on the scene now. Remember, 1054 AD, Roman Catholicism is born. It's still developing, but it's pretty much there. So faith plus works. We already kind of saw that with Gregory, right? The idea of baptismal regeneration. You can, for sins that you commit, you need to do acts of love. Well, this becomes rampant at this time, just in general, faith plus works. Concerning the Eucharist, there is development once again. We talked about Radbertus and Ratramnus. Now, Aquinas comes on the scene. You've probably heard the name Thomas Aquinas. And he develops the doctrine of what we call transubstantiation, all right? Which I'm not actually sure that the Catholic Church actually agrees with what Aquinas said. Nevertheless, if you ask a Catholic, what do you believe concerning the Eucharist? They would say, I believe in transubstantiation. And that was developed by St. Aquinas, all right? But Aquinas developed this idea that, we have time. So, all right. So this is Aquinas, okay? Things have substance, and they also have accidents, okay? And this is what he means. If you look at a tree, all right, you recognize it as a tree because of its inner substance, its inner being. That's what identifies it distinctly as a tree, all right? However, its appearance, the idea, okay, it's brown, it's hard, right? This is what Aquinas would call its accident. Its inner being is to be distinguished from its accident. What it's like is not necessarily what makes it what it is in Aquinas's view. I know, this is crystal clear. This isn't me, this is just Aquinas. So with respect to the Eucharist, all right, you have the bread and the wine, and when the priest consecrates it, the substance of these elements becomes Christ, right? It becomes the body and the blood of Christ in substance, right? So in its innermost ontological reality. However, its accident remains static and unchanged. So it's still bread and wine, but it's really the body and blood of Christ. Yeah. So anyway, so that's Aquinas. I tend to think that it is just bread and wine, and we do it out of remembrance of him, because, you know, that's what it says. But nevertheless, transubstantiation is developed by Aquinas, and the Catholic Church embraces it. Once again, at this time, purgatory is fully embraced, and the veneration of the saints and Mary are just full-fledged rampant, right? I already told you that the East responded in horror when they found out that the Catholic Church was venerating statues, because in their mind, that is just grossly pagan, right? Pictures are so much more acceptable to venerate than statues. So that's dealing about 1200 AD, right? That's kind of our walkthrough of church history at this point. We obviously know that later on you have the reformers. But it's not as though Martin Luther and Calvin and these reformers were the first ones to object to Rome. What we haven't touched on, and we will not really touch on, is there were various other groups, not just individuals, groups that were against what Rome was teaching the entire way along. And there's a book that I would recommend to you if you're interested. It's called Long Before Luther. It's by Nathan Busnitz. And he just traces the gospel throughout church history, okay? So when you hear people saying, oh, you know, the gospel was lost in the Dark Ages or whatever it may be, that's just an ignorance of church history. So that's the point, right? Christ has been faithful to his church. You see him building the church. We see the problems with the church. Nevertheless, to say that Roman Catholicism is what the church has always believed is just grossly inaccurate.